This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and it's Friday, so we'll dive right into our week in review. And we'll start with a developing story about a disturbing incident at the Museum of Fine Arts.
We're terribly sorry that the students had an experience that was not what we wish for anybody who visits the museum.
That's MFA Chief Brand Officer Katie Getchell speaking to Channel 7 about allegations brought forward by a group of Dorchester Middle School students and their teacher. They say they were racially profiled and harassed during a recent field trip, targeted by hateful racist remarks from other patrons and followed by a museum security guard. Here's teacher Marvelline Lammy on Channel 5.
As soon as we would walk, he would walk. When we stopped, he would stop. So at that point, I kind of grew uncomfortable. So I just told the kids, we're going to gather up and go.
Makiba McCreary, Chief of Learning and Community Engagement at the MFA, told WBUR that the museum will look into the incident, but she's most concerned about what happens next.
I would like to argue that it's even more so about what happens after that, which is ensuring that they know they belong here when they come into this museum, that they feel like it's their museum.
So what does happen next, and how do we make institutions like museums, predominantly white spaces, feel like it belongs to everyone? Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. Joining us this week is Tito Jackson. He's CEO of Verdant Medical and a former Boston City Councilor. Councilor Jackson, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us this week is Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, good to see you as well.
Great to be back with you.
So we were just talking in the newscast about this, and I want to bring it to our listeners here live on the show and start with your reactions to this story, Tito.
It is obviously angering and frustrating. This is racism. And, you know, in the apology, let's start there. So institutions need to learn how to apologize. Conditional apologies. And I want to give props to my friend Tori Bullock, who did a video on this. So when you say it's not who we are, no, actually, it is who we are. It may not be who you aspire to be, but it is who you are. And so one of the things that we were saying a little bit earlier is that as a black person, oftentimes you need CSI level information or evidence to prove that something went on. And sadly, this is an actual institution in the city of Boston. And we know that institutions are made up of not only buildings, but people. And so there's a cultural component that needs to be dealt with here. And it is also very upsetting to me. These are 13-year-olds. These are young people. And oftentimes, young black and Latino kids aren't really allowed to be young people. And it's really frustrating to me that in addition to it happening, that the response is kind of a covering of our tuchus instead of actually stepping forward to deal with these. And I do want to give props, and I want to make the distinction. Makiba McCreary has, I believe, made some very good statements. And I guess the last thing I'll say here is that look at your staff. Look at the makeup of your staff. So I went on the website. Mm-hmm. I want the MFA to look at their board. And I also want the MFA to actually look at the fact that Makiba McCreary is the only senior level person of color in the organization other than and I know that there's a curator there. They need to really look at this as a teachable moment and determine what the next iteration of the MFA is.
So you said a lot there. But one of the things you said was about this sort of apology culture and that's not who we are. And I think you might be referencing something that Marty Walsh said yesterday, at least to the Boston Globe. He said he finds what happened at the MFA disturbing and, quote, that's not who we should be and that's not who we are. But Boston City Councilor Kim Janney tweeted this last night. I'm so tired of the this is not who we are response to racism in Boston. That's exactly who we are. How can we move forward if response is always denial? Tom Nichols. Is this who we are as a city, as a country?
I hope not. I think I understand. Of course, I'm not African-American. This hasn't happened to me. And so it's easier for me to say I understand when people say this is not who we are because, of course, that's not who you want to be. But I also take the point that it's not who we are, but it's who somebody is who did the thing that was so disturbing. And I think it's almost healthier for an institution simply to say, look, somebody screwed up. We're going to find out what happened. You know, this is a bad thing instead of the, well, it wasn't the experience we wanted and we're, you know, and you go back and forth. you know, society's made up of human beings, and some of them are just bad people. You know, institutions are not going to have perfect people in them. And it's okay to admit that rather than to go through, you know, again, are we doing this en masse? And therefore, because I think what happens is institutions in general dig in and say, we have to say this is not who we are because we can't, you know, that's something we don't want to live with, and that's understandable. But like I said, it may not be who you are, but it's who somebody was.
I challenge institutions and I challenge people to sit with the uncomfortability of this, to sit with and actually deal with, and as a person of color, women, people from the LGBTQ community, you know what? It's uncomfortable. When people follow you around in a store and you possibly had a pocket full of money that you thought about spending there, and you feel like a second-class citizen when that happens. And so it's absolutely critical that people don't jump to this, hey, we're going to instantly fix it, that sit with it. Listen to what these young people are saying about what they experience and what they feel. And by the way, they're now 13, so this is not the first time that some of them have dealt with many of these issues. And we challenge you, institutions in the city of Boston, because by the way, when people talk about Boston writ large, we are sports teams, institutions, all of these other pieces. And there have been things that have happened in all of these venues. And so the confluence of that is something critical that we actually sit with. And as a person of color, we don't get to walk away hit the send button and be all done with this issue. I challenge the MFA to go out into every single Boston public school and have these interfaces. Boston public schools are about 80% students who are Black or Latino. And then we have about 7-8% Asian students. You know, get out there. Make these connections. By the way, hire some of them. Put them on your board, mm-hmm. and actually help them determine the next generation of what this museum is going to look like. Because by the way, they are the people in the city of Boston who will be going there. They are the ones, and we know the city of Boston and communities of color is younger and much browner. So they are your future. So if you don't do the right thing, your institution will not last into this next millennium.
Well, as we reported on WBUR, about 80% of the MFA's attendance, at least in 2015, is white. And so as part of that, we spoke to Stephen Locke. He was the artist in residence for the city of Boston in 2018 and a professor at MassArt. And he told us that this incident really shows why it has been so difficult to make places like museums, operas, and ballets more inclusive.
Culture is not white. Art is not white. What is happening is white supremacy is saying that these things belong to us and they don't belong to you. The barriers to going are the biases that people have about the audience. Black people like the ballet. Black people like opera. Black people like all that stuff. Why they aren't going is because the institutions don't welcome them.
So is there a way to make these institutions welcoming beyond what you just said, Councillor Jackson?
Well, first off, one, we need to use the word, and I know it's now a bad word, we need to use the word racism and stop dancing around what's going on and embrace it. Yes, there is an opportunity to actually rework these institutions. But one, it starts with coming to the table knowing that you don't know, knowing that you don't have the staff, necessarily the skill sets or training, and actually asking, actually building real relationships with neighborhoods and communities, but also putting people in positions of power and in leadership. And so that, to me, is a reflection of the institution. If you don't have people at the top tier of leadership at your institution, and you say that you believe in diversity, well, you know, when I was a city councilor, I would always say a budget is a value statement. So if you don't have people who are guiding your budgets as a whole, then that becomes an issue. And by the way, there's a bunch of fun things that happen at MFA. They recently had a really awesome party. I won't say it online, but it was oriented towards the Black community. It was really awesome. There's the First Fridays event, but when it comes down to it, those don't happen in a vacuum. and a bubble. When it comes down to what we have to do as a city and as a community, is we have to be willing to roll our sleeves up and have real, authentic conversations where people of color are at the table and not subordinated. The biggest issue in this situation is these young people actually felt, when they walked in there, uncomfortable about everything that was going on.
Speaking of institutions, good time to remind everybody, I don't speak for any of the ones I work for. you know, I admit, you know, there's a part of me that shuts down when someone says, you know, people don't go to the ballet because of white supremacy. On the other hand, it's, I think it's a really important point. When 80% of your students are children, you know, of color, are people of color, and 80% of your patrons are white, that there's a disconnect in the community. Yep. And I think that there's, you know, that's, it's a great thing to work to overcome that disconnect. Some of the remedies that Tito's talking about, I think that that makes perfect sense. And whether it's, you know, institutional white supremacy, keeping people away from art or the ballet. Again, I'm not a member of a minority group. I don't know what that experience is like, but I'm not sure that that's a productive approach.
It sounds
either.
Like. Sitting down at the table, having these conversations, hopefully can make a difference.
But you have to make a change, though. Understand, this is like addition and subtraction, right? So when it comes down to changing what's on the other side of the equal sign, if your outcome from what you currently are doing right now is 80% of the folks in a city that's a majority people of color,
right.
80% of the people who are coming in are white, then if this were some, if you were selling candy bars or something else, you would actually really be thinking about that that marketing and that marketplace. The question is, when it comes down to the real issue here is, do these institutions actually care to make the modifications? I'm hearing that the MFA wants to come to the table. I absolutely believe that they should come to the table. And I'm on the board, and I actually need to note I'm on the board of the Boston Ballet. And these are some of the issues and questions that we deal with on a regular basis. Because just as noted with Mr. Locke, people, you know what? Black folks like ballet. And these cultural institutions should be open to everyone and not some people. And by the way, if you're going to survive in the future of the nation as well as the city of Boston, you better get this right. And these young people, by the way, are going to be around a long time after all of us are here. So if you believe in your institution and want to see it grow and thrive in the future, you better fix it.
I have long, long memories. And you know, wow, we want to make sure we leave some time for other topics today, including politics. It's just a small topic. the president this week reportedly stormed out of a meeting with Democrats on Wednesday, upset over Speaker Nancy Pelosi's accusation that Trump is engaged in a cover-up. He then stepped out into the Rose Garden and said this.
Well, it turns out I'm the most, and I think most of you would agree to this, I'm the most transparent president probably in the history of this country.
And Speaker Pelosi responded, sounding more like she was talking about a troubled relative than the leader of the free world.
I pray for the president of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country.
Of course, she stopped short of calling for impeachment, and there's a split in the Democratic Party over this idea. Pelosi has held strong that the party should not go down that road just yet, but according to an NBC News count, some 31 House Democrats have now called for the impeachment process to begin. So let's start there. Is impeachment, Tom Nichols, a trap for the Democrats?
There's no good solution now. I think that impeachment may be politically unpopular, but at this point, it could well be a constitutional duty. I mean, you know, you can't avoid doing something that the Democrats can't step forward and say he's obstructed justice, he's abused power. But for the
Pelosi's
sake of,
even said that, you know, he's right. definitely committed impeachable
right.
offenses.
He's committed impeachable offenses,
in
but for
view.
The sake of political expediency, we're actually not going to go down that road. I think Republicans are very much hoping to draw the foul here. And to have a Bill Clinton moment where he goes through impeachment, goes out on the South Lawn, you know, cheers. Of course, people forget that the year after Bill Clinton was acquitted, a Republican won the White House. So, you know, there may be other lessons in there. But I think in some extent, the president
razor thin Supreme Court margin,
but unexpectedly. You know, I mean, a stronger, you know, as we Republicans always said at the time, if Al Gore could have won his home state, he'd have been president, and he didn't. So, you know, there's a – I mean, there are risks for the Democrats, but I think it's getting – and I was actually more sympathetic to that early on, to say I get it. They don't want to go down the – because the Senate's going to acquit them no matter
right.
what. I mean, the Republican Party is completely a monolith at this point from top to bottom, with the honorable exception of Justin Amash of – you know, just kind of standing alone. But on the other hand, you know, if you don't – if this isn't impeachable, if the president's behavior isn't impeachable, then you might as well just scratch it out of the Constitution, because if this isn't it, nothing is.
Now, Tito Jackson, as I said, Democrats are split over this issue. And this week we spoke with Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark and asked her what she thought of the disagreement within the party over whether to pursue impeachment.
I think what it shows is that while our party may have some differences in timing and tactics, we are more committed than ever in making sure that we hold this president accountable.
Now, the president would argue this is all just a witch hunt, but are Democrats holding him accountable?
I think Democrats need to hold each other accountable for having a backbone and actually standing up and ensuring that we do what's right, which may not always be what's popular. And so this is the and by the way, this is the quandary of the Democratic Party, right, is what to do in these difficult situations. These are the rallying cries. And so, by the way, I don't believe there's a middle anymore. Right. So this component of like, hey, we're going to play to the middle and the independents in the middle. You're not getting them. And so what you need to do.
So you don't think the middle exists anymore?
When you're in a situation when you're saying Trump or no Trump, I don't think there's a middle there, right? I think maybe in 2016 there might have been some folks, and you had people who were Bernie or bust or some or they're the same. I don't think that that's necessarily the case now. I think there needs to be bold, courageous leadership that actually steps up and holds him to account. And that would also galvanize a Democratic base that didn't come out for Hillary. So this is the other component, is that you didn't see those Obama level turnouts. And that's why states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, that we weren't actually able to pull that together. So I personally believe in I heard a funny thing that we have a Baskin-Robbins, almost a Baskin-Robbins election.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. 32 different flavors. But when it comes down
to this.
For a
minute there, it was 23 in Maine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, 23 in Maine. I like that. Right.
I'm not running.
But I think there's definitely something that should come out of this that could also galvanize the Democrats.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, I think there are two things going on here. One is, you know, as somebody who's part of the Never Trump camp, I always worry that Democrats are going to
stay in that camp.
And I've stayed in that camp.
I
have never, from day one until now, as Ronald Reagan would say, I stayed the course. I always worry that Democrats are going to be too consumed by their internecine struggles. I mean, when Jay Inslee and, I can't even name some of the other guys that are running for president, Bill de Blasio, it's like this to me is the Democrats potentially taking their eye off the ball. The other thing I think is happening, though, is I think Pelosi wants to get to the point where she says, look, we backed ourselves against the wall and tried every possible way to avoid this, and he has left us no choice. So I think if Representative Clark is right, and this is where, because it sounds like she's hinting that's where
right.
they're moving,
mm-hmm.
I think Pelosi wants to be able to say,
we tried to avoid
this. We tried everything we could. Even that thing about an intervention was almost like her saying, will someone please do something that isn't us? And I think, that rubbed me a little bit the wrong way, because she's like, if only someone would stage an intervention. Well, you being the Article I power of the Constitution, you actually have that power to do that. But I think that's what they're trying to get to, so that they don't look like they rushed into it.
So this Week in Review has gotten away from us. We're short on time here, and I just want to make sure that we leave some space for our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tom, let's start with you.
I have a joint Massachusetts-Rhode Island hubbub, because I'm a son of the Commonwealth who was transplanted to Rhode Island, and it's about the president putting his finger on the scale of this casino bill, trying to advantage the casinos that are run by friends of his in Rhode Island. And the reason I thought of this and the reason it made me laugh is that I just spent a week on vacation in Las Vegas, and it's so weird to come back to New England and say, boy, it was really nice to be someplace where gaming is really clean and above board and well run.
Are you looking to buy the Wynn Casino?
No, I'm not giving Steve Wynn another dime.
And
Councilor Jackson,
this is I was actually going to steal the Wynn Casino as my hubbub since it wasn't brought up. I think this is actually it shows how important the issue of having a gaming commission who actually puts in the right language. There should never have been language that allowed them an out in their ability to have that say to push the sale forward.
And you're talking about, of course, this back and forth this past week between MGM and Wynn, whether they were going to swap or something,
exactly,
sell the Everett Casino.
And you know, we see that many of these corporate essentially giveaways become an issue, and we also see the same when it comes to General Electric. You had the state of Massachusetts pitch in $87 million to purchase a building for a private company and then allow them to sell it for $252 million and to give us back $98 million. This reminds me of when my mom sent me to the store with $20. I wasn't that great always at giving the change back with the candy, right? And so this is, again, the type of thing that we need to look at in terms of the deals that the state as well as municipalities cut with these large corporate entities.
I think it would be great one day to have a really detailed conversation as well about whether or not it's morally acceptable to keep trying to generate income by plopping casinos into depressed areas. Because I enjoy gambling recreationally. I love going to Las Vegas or, you know, to Foxwoods, but I think that's wrong.
Tom, hubbubs are supposed to be fun.
I know.
I threw the dice on that one.
We're
tight on time, but that's Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
And Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and former Boston City Councilor. Thank you as well.
Shout out to Boston Answering, which is happening this weekend.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.